It's Doug here. I wanted to pop in before we go to the episode. This is part two of a conversation with Rusty. And if you missed part one, you probably should go back and check it out. Otherwise, you're just jumping in the middle of a conversation. You'll still be able to figure it out, but I would advise you to check out last week's episode so that you'll be able to follow right in seamlessly. If you didn't catch the outro for last week, basically we started recording. It ended up being about 2 hours long, and we decided to record. However, we wanted to divide it up into two episodes. So this is the conclusion of the two-parter. So thanks a lot to Rusty, and I'll send it to the episode now. Okay, let's move into setting up debt facilities. So I think in one of the appearances you mentioned buy, borrow, die, that strategy. Then we recorded, if I remember right, we recorded another episode where we focused on it and people are super interested. And I think that is part of this, but we really haven't done any of this in our household. What did you start to do? And do you have some tips for folks here?
Well, this is the one area of this, like this bigger conversation that we're having where we actually didn't do this very well in advance. And it bit us on the back end because it was harder to set up some of these debt structures after we quit work. And we didn't realize how much of an uphill struggle we had created for ourselves. We did all this stuff successfully. So you can still do it even if you miss the boat the first time. But so that's why I'm trying to share it now. So hopefully someone in the audience can start thinking about this earlier. I've made this point before, but I think it's worth reiterating. I think the FIRE people are the only people who can use debt responsibly. And I think the credit card points are a good analogy. You know, in the FIRE community, we're always talking about all these games about how you can get these sign-up bonuses and maximize the points and go on free trips and travel and things like that. And if you listen to Dave Ramsey, and especially if you listen to Dave Ramsey's callers, like they would be the worst people in the world to tell them to start like taking out credit cards to maximize points because they would just result in overspending. Similarly, I think there's other ways that the FIRE people can use debt responsibly. So this is a very tailored message. I would not give this message to the general audience, the general American audience, but I feel like this is a pretty advanced topic that people listening to this show can handle. Yeah, again, to reiterate, much of this becomes much more difficult after your W-2 income stops. The big one would be to either refinance your mortgage, take out a second mortgage, or buy a home while you're still working. Even if you want to move, like we moved from Chicago to Colorado, if we would have done that during that last year of work when I was slacking off, it would have been way easier for us to get a mortgage. When I was trying to call around and get a mortgage, we hadn't had any W-2 income for like 4 months at that point. And I mean, people weren't even returning my calls. They're like, why would I even talk to this person? Or, you know, you fill out a form online with a bank and then it's just crickets. No one would talk to you. But we did find two bankers who responded to us and were trying to give us a mortgage, and we could shop them. We could negotiate them against each other. We had two options. So it ended up working out okay. But if we would have just done it a few months earlier when we both had our six-figure jobs, it would have been such an easy conversation to get a mortgage, especially the one on our Boulder place. The refinancing the mortgage too. So that's even if you already have a house, trying to refinance it, even if rates are just even somewhat favorable. And if you're in the current situation where you're locked into one of those super low rates from pandemic times before the inflation kicked in, that might be a good time to take out a second mortgage. Growing up, you'd hear about people taking out second mortgages and it sounded like the end of the world. And that's because they're living beyond their means and trying to finance their lifestyle just by taking on debt that they can't afford to take on, you know, their negative net worth and things like that. But I think there's a really good case for taking out a second mortgage if you're financially responsible and you can get a even somewhat decent rate. 5-6% rate on a mortgage is much lower than the 10% average return of the S&P 500. So you're taking advantage of that delta when you're taking out debt at a low interest rate and keeping your assets in something that has a high rate of return. Along similar lines, you can open up a HELOC That's another one that there's been some pushback with the banks, with us not having the W-2. It's more tied to the value of the house. So, but I think the banks do take up a holistic view of those. I don't love the HELOC, that we haven't taken any money out with the HELOC, but it's nice to have it as an option in case you need money in a pinch. And the main thing that I don't like about the HELOC is that the rates tend to be a little higher and they're not tied to an index. They just seem to be based on whatever the bank thinks they can charge, and most of them are adjustable. Or in fact, the only ones I've been able to find, I haven't looked extensively, but they're all adjustable. So we have a HELOC, but we don't have any, we haven't taken anything out on it. So
gotcha. What is the rate on that?
Oh man, I don't, I mean, it varies a lot, but I think it ends up being more like, I think historically it ends up being closer to 7%. And I know historically the securities backed lines of credit, which is what we use, are around 5%.
And it moves around all the time.
It moves. I don't know what they are. Yeah. I mean, I don't know what they are at the moment, but I know historically, roughly where they are.
Quick question before you move on to the next. So taking out a second mortgage, can you talk about the mechanics of like the advantage of doing that, even at the higher rates right now?
Yeah. So, I mean, the advantage of doing that, the general idea behind doing it is you're taking that money out of your home equity, and then you're essentially investing it into the stock. Like what we would do in our situation is we would invest that all into S&P 500 index fund shares. And what you're doing is you're taking advantage of the fact that there's a delta between the rate of return on the stock market, which is for S&P 500, 10.3% historically. And then the second mortgage, you would probably be locking in something around like 6% right now. And so there's a 4% delta there. And then this is the math side of things, but basically both of them are compounding in a way that's favorable to you, because with the mortgage, you're paying off the debt on a monthly basis. So the amount of interest you pay the next year is actually going down. And then with the stock market investments, you're accumulating the interest, which means you have more principal the next year to accumulate even more interest on. So it's not as simple as saying like, oh, 10%, 6%, there's a 4% delta. The 6% debt payment is actually more like effectively like a 5% stock market return. It's pretty complicated math to figure it out, and it changes based on the exact interest rate that you're paying. But because it's decreasing each year, you could basically take a point or two off of what the interest rate is for the purposes of determining how beneficial it is for you over a 30-year period.
Okay.
That's some pretty complicated math, but I also think it's something that people don't mention enough because they'd be like, oh, 10% mortgage, 10% stock market return, it's a wash. And actually, because of the interest on the principal on the debt getting paid off, your interest goes down every year with the mortgage. So
gotcha.
So there's actually a little bit of an advantage.
And then there's minor transaction fees, right? But
yeah, it ends up being about like $8,000 has been our experience, or at least that seems to be pretty standard too. That has been our experience, is that's like about an $8,000 transaction fee. You pay for an appraisal, they charge you some fees to take things on. Most of them will give you the opportunity to put those fees into the mortgage payment if you want, but then it ends up being about a wash, you know. Okay. So you can either pay them up front or you can put them into the mortgage payment.
And a few years ago when interest rates were much lower, then it's kind of a slam dunk.
The math was overwhelming. That's when you would definitely want to do it, is if you're working, knowing you're going to quit, you own a home and the rates are really low, then you can just straight up refinance too, which is a little bit cleaner than taking out the second mortgage. And some banks will give you a higher rate on a second mortgage, but some of them, we've at least found some of them where it's pretty close to the market rate for just your standard mortgage.
Yeah. Cool. And then the more exciting one is the more rare that people don't take advantage of is securities backed.
Yeah. That we didn't open that until afterwards. We didn't actually have any problem opening the securities-backed line of credit after we stopped working, because it's totally tied to your equities, and you're putting your, you're basically putting your stocks or your index funds up as collateral for a loan. But I still think that would be a nice one to get set up before you stop working, because it gives you a lot more liquidity options right off the bat. And if we had had that set up right off the bat, I think we wouldn't have sold shares the first few months, which the first few months we were doing our retirement, we were selling shares. So,
right.
Yeah. And I've gone in depth on that in a couple episodes, so I won't say too much more, but maybe we'll link to that in the show notes, the one where I talked about that for 40 minutes or so.
Yes. So we'll link to that. So that's perfect. Yeah. Super interesting. And some of our friends, I think Carl and Pete and maybe, and probably some other folks, they have a lot of equities, and when they bought houses and stuff like that, like that's an easy way for them to give a cash offer, cut the mortgage broker out of the whole situation, and then they kind of control things a little bit more, and they could operate much faster.
Yeah, there's there's a bunch of benefits. One for us is that you know we're not generating what appears as income, so we're able to avoid that healthcare subsidy cliff. So we still get our full healthcare subsidy, and then for us too, I mean, we've had 14% average annual stock market returns since we've retired. And the rate that we're paying, like our blended rate is around 4% on our interest on our securities backed loans. So that's like a 10% delta right there. That move alone has made us, I mean, that move alone, because we've had such a good, we have such a low loan rate and such good stock market returns, we've made $1 million easily
just doing that
in 5.5 years of retirement. And I know Charles Schwab has one, they call it a pledged asset line. Morgan Stanley is what we're with, they have, it's called liquidity asset line. And then Robinhood has been doing these promotions. They had one at the end of the year that was like really good. And their, I forget what their rate was, but it was four point something percent on these loans, which is the best out there right now from what I can find. And they were giving you 3% of your, a one-time payment of 3% for any assets you transferred over. They stopped that at the end of the year, but they might do a similar promotion at some point. I think the Robinhood one is the one I would do if I was starting off initially. But I will say this too, is we got in with Morgan Stanley because they were doing a promotion, and now their rates are higher than some of the competitors. We've locked in those lower rates. We locked them in for 7 years, but the new debt that we're taking out is at a higher rate than we would with some of the competitors. So this Robinhood promotion is might be a similar thing where they get you in, and the Robinhood rate isn't tied to a benchmark either, and it's not for any guaranteed period of time. So there are some risks of doing it, but
interesting.
But at least their advertised rates at the moment are the lowest.
Before we move on, just so people get an idea, so you mentioned there's like a 7-year term on the ones that you have, or at least one of them. How much did you borrow from your equities?
We took out, right off the bat when they were doing that promotion, we took out, I think, $625,000, and we put a big chunk of that right off the bat to down payment on our Boulder house. And then the other chunk was going to be to renovate the Boulder house. We were just basically like, that'll be our refinancing fund. But then we had to take out another big chunk of that to do the down payment on Breckenridge. And then we did, then we had a little bit left over for renovating, but then we had to take out over $500,000 for the renovations too. And now the total that we're at is like, oh crap, it's like $2 million. But that also is like, we're taking out over 6 figures a year to pay the interest on our debt currently. So between our mortgages and our securities backed line of credit. So you do have to think, I had a listener email me about this, cause they're like, this is crazy. It throws off the math. According to my court calculations, you're going to run out of money in 14 years. And I sent him the spreadsheet that I'd done for our episode. And I was like, oh, here's my math. Like, and he's like, oh, I didn't understand this fully, but we're paying, we think of it in terms of like true cash flow, but we have to make these debt payments every year. So we basically treat our debt payments as totally separate from our our living expenses, and we make sure we're trying to spend our, you know, 4%, or we're staying well under our 4% on our annual living expenses, but our actual cash flow for the year is like insane, because yeah, our debt payments are over six figures. So it would look more like maybe we're spending like 8% of our total income, but we think of that as a totally separate bucket. And that's the amount that we're paying to avoid paying capital gains tax, to keep getting a healthcare subsidy, and to keep our assets in stocks where they continue to grow. Mm-hmm. So that's like our small fee to continue to get to keep making hundreds of thousands of dollars on the other end.
And then I keep saying it's the last one.
No.
But
people are super interested in it. When I first gave out that email on like an episode, like four episodes ago or whatever, the first two people who emailed me were just like super hot about buy, borrow, die and had so many questions. So
roughly 100K a year paying the debt on what you borrowed, which is, you said, about 2 million.
I think it's like 2 million total. Yeah.
Really?
Well, plus our mortgages, which is like, you know, so it's more another. Like four million, in debt.
From where do you get that 100K?
So you take out more debt, yeah. Okay. So we take out more from our securities-backed line of credit. Part of that we view as true cash flow, because to the extent we're paying off the principal on our mortgages, which is, and because property taxes are so low in Colorado, it's almost half of our mortgage payment goes to just paying off the principal. So that's just pure cash flow. But yeah, every time we have anything, we just take out more debt, which is, I mean, it sounds insane.
It sounds like you're over leveraged, but the thing is, you're keeping more money invested. So you've taken out money and you're reinvesting most of it, hence the delta in the interest rate, or the interest rate versus the growth.
And most of this money that we've taken out has gone into our homes, and our homes, I think, even by very conservative estimates, have appreciated in value. So yeah, it's like we have all this debt, but our homes are worth close to $4 million. And that's where a lot of the debt, comes from. So we don't feel like that's actually super, super risky.
Because there's value. It's almost like you're saving money by doing it.
Right. And then it's like, instead of like, say we had $5 million just in equities, simple, now we have $5 million in equities plus $4 million in homes. So we've almost doubled the size of our assets. But then we have all that debt then too. So,
Man,
using we have $4 million in debt, but we have $4 million extra in assets.
Right.
So, yeah.
And you're using all the brain power that you were doing all your lawyering with for.
Right.
For now this. Super interesting. So people refer to the episode. It sounds like it shouldn't work, but I've talked to enough people where it's like, get your ducks in a row.
I'm doing it. It makes me feel good, honestly, that Pete and Carl are doing it too. like, I'm not. You do the math and you're like, oh, the math is really, really good. But there's something that feels super weird about, especially in the FIRE community. I think people tend to have that mindset of they want to see as little money leaving their accounts as possible. And you're kind of opening the floodgates on how much money is flowing out, but it's grown our net worth significantly. So,
Awesome. Okay. We'll link up and then do your due diligence before you email Rusty. We don't want him to get like a million emails out there trying to coach you through it. I think you recorded with my friend Justin Dragon, right?
Fit Rich Life, episode 99. And he went on, like, we talked about just buy, borrow, die for almost an hour. So, because he's like on the edge of wanting to do it himself, but he wanted to like get all of his questions answered about it. So,
very cool. Okay. Moving on to healthcare. So this is one of the things that kind of held us back. Elizabeth was from the healthcare industry, so she knows how complicated and sloppy and horrible many of the, just everything about it is. So pretty sure that was one of the mystery factors that kept her working a little bit longer. Eventually she got confident with it, and it's one of those things where it might be more expensive than we were hoping or thinking it could be, but it is a problem you could solve with money. So let's talk about healthcare.
Yeah. And I think you made this note too, but I think it's one of the big contributors to the one more year syndrome. Maybe just starting with our own experience, I mean, we've had about as bad of a, from a financial standpoint, we've had as bad of a healthcare situation as you get could get. We've had over $1 million in medical bills since we retired. We have, and we hit the out-of-pocket max, so paid as much as we could for healthcare for four of the 5 years that we've been retired. This isn't something I was planning, but you realize that you can't, that you need more than one thing to go wrong. Or one of the things that's taught me is that you need more than one thing to go wrong for your retirement plan to fail. And because the stock market has been so strong, having those years where you hit your max, and what we found is, like, when we hit our max, it ends up being around $28,000 to $32,000 a year with all your premium payments plus all of your out of pocket stuff. You know, that sucks. Obviously, if you're doing Lean Fire, that would be crappy. But if you're also doing Lean Fire, like, I mean, you'd have to go back to work immediately, but you'd probably want to maybe start planning something, building something into your long-term plan. But for us, it's been totally compensated for by the fact that we've had really good stock market years. And as I alluded to, our net worth is still up significantly, like almost double over 5.5 years of retirement. So just to the extent healthcare is scary, just know that we've hit essentially the worst case scenario in terms of how much you could be paying financially, and it hasn't derailed our personal plan. There's a couple different ways to do healthcare when you leave your job. The one is staying on the employer plan. That was our experience. My wife was technically fired, but she was working for the airline as during COVID, and they were offering buyouts, and she took a buyout, which I think surprised her colleagues significantly. But because of that, part of her severance or buyout package, I mean, buyout package is essentially a severance, but she got to stay on her employer healthcare for 7 months, I think. And United Airlines is one of the biggest employers, if you think of all the frontline employees and everything that they have. So they had really good healthcare, great healthcare plan. You know, they're basically one of the biggest insurance, and one of the biggest clients that an insurance company could sign up. So they've negotiated all these really nice concierge services. And yeah, we got to stay on that for 7 months. So that was a benefit of my wife not just straight up quitting, but taking a buyout plan. And the buyout plans will have stuff like that in them. And then, the other aspect of that is it's heavily subsidized by the employer. So that was a huge benefit to be able to keep. But even if you weren't getting a buyout, if you were negotiating a severance, staying on healthcare, I think, is a very common thing that people can do. Once that ended, we saw the COBRA rates. And the COBRA rates, you lose the employer subsidy, plus it's 150% of what the employer pays for your individual plan. So COBRA was just not even really an option. Crazy at expensive. That point. So yeah. At that point, we went to what would be your other option, which is going to the marketplace. And so if you're fired, if you have a qualifying event, which being fired or quitting your job, losing employment is a qualifying event, you can go to the marketplace even outside of the open enrollment period and buy a plan. I had reached out while we were still working, I'd reached out to a health insurance broker. The particular one I reached out to ended up being horrible because he just basically put my contact information on like a leads generation sheet that he sent out to like 100 other health insurance brokers. So I just got inundated with calls. So that sucked. But here, we found one here in Colorado that didn't do that. Just was more of a straightforward guy who was trying to just sell us a plan directly, not sell our information as a lead to someone else. And he just walks through us, he's really informed about all the plans and the coverage in the Boulder area. He knows just like off the top of his head, he's like essentially memorized like which providers are covered by which plan. He verifies all that too. And he gets us into the like very specific, perfect plan, helps us determine whether we're doing gold, silver, bronze. I would say reaching out to someone like this before you're retired is a huge thing. And then that way, you can sign up for the insurance when you're in that qualifying period after your job ends or whatever. They'll help make sure that that happens. And then we don't pay him anything. I think he gets a referral fee basically from the marketplace plans that he sells us. So the insurance companies are on the marketplace. If it comes into them a certain way, they pay back a fee to the broker that sent them the business essentially. And then there's one more healthcare thing post-retirement that I think it's important to think through, and that's just making sure that you stay off of Medicaid and that you also don't inadvertently fall off of the subsidy cliff. Mm-hmm. And so there's a sweet spot. It's like for a family of three, it's 20 something thousand. You have to have more than that in income so that you don't get kicked onto Medicaid. And then I'm totally blanking on what our number is for the subsidy cliff, but it's like something around like 70 to 90,000, mm-hmm. which I realize is a big range and I should be more specific. I think ours is around like 90,000 right now. But you can look it up online and you should be looking it up online.
Talk to your account. Yeah.
Don't just go off of my memory on this podcast, but so there's a balancing act there. And you and I have had conversations too, where you were planning to do the Roth IRA conversion ladder, but then you realized you didn't want to go off of the subsidy cliff and lose the healthcare subsidy. So
exactly. Yep. And you kind of have to dial it in and pay attention. I turned down my business and shut down courses and turned off revenue and income kind of for this. And I mean, the previous year, I think we were paying for the two of us maybe $850 a month or something like that. And then with the subsidy, it went down to maybe like $250. It went up this past year. So now in 2026, maybe it's like $350. I can't remember exactly, but that's roughly correct. And yeah, the income.
But that's like $6,000 a year, from getting the subsidy. And you didn't get it your first year because you had some income. Yeah.
Yep. Exactly. Yeah. And yep. So it's like potentially like losing the subsidy, which right now is a return of $6,000 like off the bat versus like future tax savings potentially. Blah. Anyway, so you have to do the math, but most likely the subsidy in these couple years, it's pretty valuable. Yeah, it's a little bit of a mess. I still have a solo 401k. So technically, if I do earn some more money, if I whatever have a cool affiliate deal on my other channel or something like that, then I could potentially, and I accidentally earn more money than I could put it into my 401k. And I get a few years to figure out what to do. But eventually we'll have to do, like, we should do Roth conversions. But yeah, you just have to pay attention.
Right. And I think that's one of the reasons why I say this is an important thing to think about, that last year of work, going back to the whole idea of the episode, because it's important to know, like, am I going to be in a position to stay off of, or am I going to be in a position to get the subsidy? And if so, maybe I want to do some moves to make sure I don't fall off that cliff.
Right.
And I should say about the subsidies too, there's obviously been a lot of news and politics happening around them, but we've still found our subsidies this year were still pretty significant, even though they were probably like 20, the subsidy part of it was like probably 20% less generous than it has been in the past. I know that varies a lot state to state, but at least out here in Colorado, subsidies are still a significant factor for consideration. And then, and then also making sure, like, oh, am I going to be in a position when I quit to be off of Medicaid. Yeah.
And then probably for you as well, but your dividends probably push you over the minimum.
Yeah.
So like if you're in a position where you're retiring early, you probably have enough dividend income to keep you out of the lower threshold.
As long as everything isn't in your retirement accounts, like your 401k and Roth IRA. There are some people in that position, and that's where the 72T could be useful, because 72T does give you taxable income, which would push you up there. So you could probably do the math to figure out what's the minimum I need to take out on my 72T to get me over that Medicaid threshold.
What's your like rough breakdown? Did you have a post-tax brokerage account, or was a lot of y'all's money in?
It was like
pre-tax.
Ours is almost all in taxable accounts, just because we were super high income. I've mentioned before, we were saving like $32,000 a month. So we would max out our 401k contributions by February every year. And then so that's, leaves 90% of the year where you're saving, and there's just not much tax advantage to do. But I know.
$32,000 a month.
Yeah.
Come so, on, man. Super relatable. Thanks.
Yeah. I know my story isn't relatable, but I'm just messing with you. Hopefully I'm trying to give you a peek behind the curtain for what retirement looks like. And, and you know, if you do reach retirement at some point, some of these lessons you'll be glad someone shared them with you.
So. Yes. I'm just teasing.
Yeah.
I know. There's a,
I'm very self-conscious about it though. I'm like, oh, I think there was even a YouTube comment where it was like, you live in Boulder and Breckenridge. Bye bye. That was on one of my episodes I was on. I was like, yeah, I live in Boulder and Breckenridge and it's pretty fucking awesome. And I know it's not relatable, but I'm also on here like teaching people about like strategies for how you can build wealth. I mean, if you want to know how to make a lot of money, like I did, I'd be like, well, go to law school and like study 70 hours a week and get really good grades and get a job at one of the top law firms. It's a really hard way to get to making a lot of money.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm sorry. I didn't know you were that self-conscious, but I mean, it means enough people saw it. YouTube is crazy out there. You guys know how it is. The funny thing is that probably means people outside of the audience, like the normal audience, our family here, they saw it. So they're like, oh yeah. And you know, that's good. Cause like more people are seeing it. We did have a comment the other day. I don't think I told you yet. Elizabeth was recently on the show and there was a comment. It was like, these guys like talk alike and they act alike and something. Are they brother and sister? And the initial reaction is like, oh, fucker, you know, come on. But you got to check out the comment. We'll link up. So people check it out and, you know, haze this commenter. But I said, good comment, right? And then that we met at a family reunion, which is super common in Georgia.
It's probably actually more of a compliment. I mean, it speaks to how close your relationship is, you and Elizabeth, but yeah.
And then, I mean, and the thing is, if you make fun of yourself, then like it disarms them. They can't really do anything.
Right.
But we're not brother, sister. We're cousins, all right? Cousins. Which also super common in Georgia. It's not even a thing. Yeah, just first cousins. Not a big deal. Yeah. It's not a big deal. Look it up, everybody. All right. This is a perfect transition. Perfect transition. I am a pro podcaster. All right. So related slightly is withdrawal strategies and a lot of discussion at Economy, which I was just at a couple of weeks ago, about withdrawal strategies. And you can do a great job accumulating, but if you don't know where you're getting your money from, can kind of freak you out. You can kind of run into analysis paralysis and you can make bad decisions if you don't know what you're doing. So did you have a handle on this leading up to it?
I didn't. And I thought I'd be okay selling shares. And then I had to start selling shares. And every single time I felt like I was just punched in the stomach. And I literally almost was close to vomiting. there was one time in particular where we took out $19,000 to buy a used Subaru Outback. And we had been no car for a long time. So that already was hard for me. And then $19,000 seemed like a lot of money and I had to sell the shares to buy it. And I was in the car dealership buying this used Subaru, sitting there with like millions of dollars too, about ready to just like almost like literally vomit, like shaking, getting so nervous. And I'm sure the other people in there were like going into debt to, you know, to like buy their cars or they were like taking out a loan that they couldn't afford. And I'm sitting there as a multimillionaire, just like, am I making the worst decision of my life? So we did not have our heads wrapped around this beforehand, but grappled with it a lot quickly and got to a point where we're good. So I think one thing that we did right away, and that we still do, is that we turned off the reinvesting our dividends function on Vanguard. So we get our dividends invested into our bank account, and those are like 1.2%. So even if you were doing the 4% rule, they would cover more than a quarter of your annual expenses. And definitely we see like the months that they hit and when those payments come out, and we're recording this on April 1st. So we just got a batch of them, but today, yeah. And I was like, oh, this will get us through easily a month and a half. So anyways, it still feels good when that money hits your account. So we did that well, and then we experimented with the sharing sales, selling shares. And as I indicated, that felt that felt horrible. And I think we would have had a really hard time spending anywhere close to where we should be spending per the 4% rule if we were having to sell shares every time. And I would just even, I would have fallen for the trap of, well, even would, let's put it off 1 month, let's put it off 2 months so that I can avoid the act of going in and selling the shares. And especially if the stock market was going up, I'd be like, well, let's ride this wave just a little bit longer. And if it was going down, I'd be like, this isn't a good time to sell because it's down. So the way we got out of that trap personally is by those securities backed lines of credit, because then you're not selling assets at in a trough. You're not worried that you're going to sell them and they're going to immediately climb the next day, and you'll have lost out on the potential returns. So that's kind of a way to kind of really, really smooth things out. We take out money when we need it, and we haven't found that we've like really escalated our lifestyle beyond what we should be, even though we have access to all this liquidity and money. It's helped us do some spendier things, but I think we've still stayed within our 4% spending every year. So yeah, so we found that the securities blocked line of credit feels way better, and especially because of the favorable market conditions we've had over the past 5.5 years. Yeah, it's made us much wealthier too. So feels good to be able to spend more money and be wealthier.
Yeah.
It's like a situation of having your cake and eating it too, but with the caveat that that's market condition dependent. And over the long run, this is a favorable strategy, but there might be a period of years where it's not a favorable strategy too.
And you mentioned the Subaru Outback, which is a good story. Is it true that you had to buy that before you could move to Colorado?
Good one.
There's a shitload of them around here.
Right, right. Yeah, they wouldn't let me get a driver's license.
They're like, check. Okay, you got your Patagonia jacket too.
We did find, I mean, even though Boulder's super bike friendly, you want to get into the mountains when you're in Colorado, and you could bike into the mountains, I guess, but that would really limit how much. Yeah, that'd be a lot of work. It would limit how much you would get into the mountains. So,
okay,
it felt good to be buying the car, knowing that we weren't buying it for commuting to work purposes. We were buying it to get into the mountains, and that's still over 50% of what we use it for.
So, yeah. Yeah, and we'll take a slight little detour on this one. So, you recently got a second car. So you were no cars in Chicago, which is cool. You guys biked and walked and it worked. And that was for like a decade or something, right?
Yep.
And then you got a car when you moved out here, knowing that things are farther apart and you would need to be able to go on adventures. You did that for several years, 4, 5, something.
We like did that. Yeah. We did that for almost 5. Yeah. Okay. Yep.
And now you have a second car.
Yep.
Big decision. Like, what'd you get? What can you tell us?
I still have these pangs, especially because I had just recorded that episode where I was like, yeah, we're just one car. and then it was like a month later, after I'd made this huge public declaration about having one car, I was like, oh, it actually makes sense for us to get a second car. But my wife couldn't bike for most of the past year. And that's always been like our second car. Like, you see those bumper stickers that say my second car is my bike. And it was literally true for us. If one of us is using the car, the other one would go out biking. And yeah, with my wife's pregnancy and her history, you know, the doctor was really like, you can't bike during this time. So we bought the second car. We got a used Nissan Leaf. I think it was like 5,600 out the door. And didn't fully appreciate this at the time, but you have to keep the battery between 80% and 20%. And so its effective range right now, I think, is like 56 miles. Okay. So it's a true like in-town car, but we have the Subaru for any bigger adventures. And we haven't really found any situations where leaving one person with a Leaf has really stranded them. And if you needed to go a little bit farther than that, like if you need to go to, I don't know, like maybe like Fort Collins or something like that, you would just drive to Fort Collins, get there, charge the car, and
stop at Bucky's on the way.
Stop maybe at Bucky's. Although Bucky's is all about gas. I don't know. Maybe they don't have electric chargers there. If you show up in an electric car, they won't serve you.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like an amusement park in there. It's cool.
Yeah. But yeah, so now we're two cars, and it does suck because I noticed I am biking less because I have the convenience of always having the car available.
Right.
But we kind of needed it at the point we were at. So yeah.
Yeah. And there's a ton of bike lanes around, but I don't feel confident out there. You guys have done a lot more, but yeah, it's a little scary biking around with so much traffic, even in Boulder, which is, it's like what, 120,000 people or something like that. I mean, mm-hmm. there's a good amount of traffic around, but
The bike lanes are just set up so nicely so that you never really cross a major street on the road. There's either underpasses or bridges. It's a great system.
So back to withdrawal strategies.
Yep.
I just had an episode, which I think it should have come out by the time this episode does, talking to Fritz Gilbert from Retirement Manifesto about buckets and the bucketing strategy. And it's a really great way to maybe alleviate the stress that you had with buying the car. And potentially you could kind of set up, refer to Retirement Manifesto, but like you could set things up so that you have buckets for when you need the money. So maybe like we know in our plan, like every 7 years, we're going to buy a new car, which is kind of inaccurate, but we'll see how it works out. But it's budgeted, so we know like maybe we need to start thinking of like where that money is going to come from for a few years ahead of time. And if you make it a little more complicated, you could have like bond ladders and different ways to make sure that like you don't have an air quote sequence of returns risk where you're like, I have to sell $50,000 worth of equities and the market's down and I feel very bad about that. You could plan for it ahead of time.
Yep.
So the buckets can be valuable. I think in the long run, you may not get as high of a return, but you don't do it for the return. You do it to guard against the downside. So that is what you're protecting.
You're guarding against the downside. And I think it's also a useful tool for people who have trouble spending enough money. Cause I think that's what a lot of the FI discussion has been about the past few years, especially with the people who are retired, having these really good, a really good sequence of returns. All this planning that we did for one of those scenarios, whereas a really bad sequence of returns turns out to be for naught. And now we're in the situation where it's like, you have to kind of figure out how to spend more or you're going to just die with a crazy amount of money. So, yeah. And I think the bucket system really helps you like do that. And you have your fun bucket. I know you've talked about a lot, and I think that's a great way to really ramp up, try to ramp up the spending. Yeah.
And one last thing, I'm pretty sure Kevin Sebesta mentioned this to me at Economy or someone else, but credit to someone else, not me. I think he set his paychecks up to go into his investment portfolio while he was still working for a couple years. And then he was getting paid regularly, his paycheck out of his investment. So he set it up ahead of time. Yep. So the system was already running. He could see if any kinks were coming, an issue. And then he would just have money go to his checking account. So it was it was already set up.
That's nice. Yeah, you would probably want to make sure that you're not selling shares and incurring the capital gains tax. So you'd want to make sure that like some of the money that comes in from the paycheck goes into cash and then you pull it out of cash.
Yep.
Yeah, that's a good system. And then I guess after you retire, you'd go in and change it so that you are selling some of your shares and not just pulling out of that cash. But that way you at least have all the mechanics set up for it. That's actually a really good idea.
Yeah, I thought it was pretty cool. Like from a mindset perspective, it's just like, I get a paycheck just like before. Yeah. I know Mark Troutman mentions that too. Just like he gets a paycheck and he knows if it shows up, like he could spend everything in that account.
Yep.
And then he had great returns over the years too. So a little too much.
Well, and if it's really starting to pile up in that account too, it's like, go think of something to do with that money. Yeah.
All right. Optimizing 401k contributions in a partial year of work. So it sounds like you guys did a pretty good job with this.
We did. We were in the top tax bracket. So every dollar we could save, or every dollar you could put into the 401k basically saved us oh gosh, what is it in the top bracket? 43 cents in tax. We had 37% top tax bracket federally, plus 5% state tax in Illinois. So felt like getting the 401k totally figured out in a partial year of work was worth it. I know you have a comment here, whether or not that was over-optimizing, but, and you know, it probably was, but I also was doing this in lieu of work. So I was doing it on the company's time, not my personal time. So, and probably got us an extra like 5,000 because we stopped working in June and August. So mine was pretty straightforward. I didn't have any match. So just at the start of that year, I just put in the max 401k contribution. So my 401k was full. And then my wife had the match, and they would only pay out the match, you know, each pay period. So they spread it out throughout the year. So if she front loaded all of her payments, she would just be missing out on the match for the back end. So we had to figure out how to ramp hers up. It was a bit of a math problem, but to ramp hers up so she was contributing the max amount those last few pay periods, or not, it wasn't the max amount actually, I'm sorry, but contributing enough to give the maximum contribution for the year and also get the maximum match, which I think is something that's pretty advanced, and this is and complicated because it's like a math problem, and it doesn't come into play for that many people. So don't know how much it's worth talking about, but maybe it's something you flag. And if you are going to be leaving work in June and you know that a few pay periods in advance, it's good to get it set up. We ran into a couple of little issues, which is like when you change your contribution rate, it doesn't go effective until the start of the next pay period. So if it's like the 7th, then you get paid on like the 15th, then it's not until, it doesn't go into effect for that paycheck you get on the 15th. It goes into the paycheck you get at the end of the month. And then there's also like the one that I had was like there were contribution limits, which was my company said you couldn't put more than 50% of any paycheck into your 401k, which I don't know why they did that. But I was like, oh, good that I figured this out, or, you know, good that I was just going to max it all out at the beginning. So it worked out effectively. If I was at the very end and I had just learned about that contribution limit because it hadn't come into play before, I would have been like, oh crap, I left some money on the table.
So, right. Yeah. Okay. Interesting. Yep. In my note on the over-optimizing, because it is the final year, the partial year. And at that point, you're talking about, for mortals, tens of thousands of dollars. For y'all, it could have been, it was in the six figures potentially because your income was so high.
And yeah. I'm just poking. Oh, well, just this, this one. Yeah. This one, it was like, yeah, maybe 10,000 okay. extra. So not worth doing a lot, but it's worth spending half a day to do the math to get $10,000. So, and like I said too, it's also, I was not working and I was trying not to work and I was trying to do as much of my personal life as possible. So it was kind of setting the right tone to be like, I'm not working right now. I'm doing this during the workday and it's for something personal. Perfect. My wife, you know, I was talking with her about this topic last night and she's like, I wish I would have done some more of that stuff on the company time. Like she never, the health insurance, she's like, I always did that on the weekend. I never took time out of work to select my employer provided health plan. And she's like, that is something that fell within the realm of work that I should have done during the workday, you know, something like this too, like your 401k contribution rate. That's something that's part of your job is, you know, making sure you get your benefits package. It's something that's, you should be able to do during the workday.
Interesting. Okay. Next is donating to charity. So this is pretty cool. We didn't do any sort of setup around, you know, charity. So I'm interested.
Yeah. You're doing some charity right now. From what I understand. Bit. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think by the time this episode comes out, there may still be some opportunity to donate, but the pancreatic cancer charity Purple Stride. So my mom passed away from pancreatic cancer a few years ago. We did a fundraiser here at HQ, a rock, paper, scissors tournament. And then we're flying down to, or we're actually traveling to Dallas for the event there in April. And some of my family's flying in. So we'll be doing some fundraising. And actually, so far, we've far exceeded whatever I thought we were going to be able to raise. And I haven't done it yet. By the time this episode comes out, there will be a small ask a small episode where I'll talk about my mom a little bit and try to encourage people to donate. But I think because we don't typically have ads on here, it'll probably do pretty well.
Yeah.
So anyway,
give.
Yeah.
Everyone out there, give to the pancreatic cancer research that Doug's fundraising for. It's a great cause.
Thank you. Yeah. So we'll link up to that so you could donate, and there'll probably be some deadline on there. So if you're listening to this years in the future, there may be a new link and you can figure out how to donate or whatever. So yes. Mm-hmm. Thanks for mentioning that.
Donating to charity. There are some very tax advantage ways of doing this, at least, you know, in the United States. I know there might be some people listening from outside, and that was something that we really tried to maximize our last year. Just going back to why you should donate, I think, you know, some people in the FIRE community in particular struggle with a scarcity mindset. And I think this is a really good way to develop a sense of abundance, to see that your money can get out there and can do some good in the world, or at least you can feel good about giving your money away. I think that just generally helps. I think they've also done studies too where it actually shows it does make you wealthier to donate. People who donate money to charity regularly, even controlling for other variables, end up being wealthier than people who don't. And one of the ways that works, or one of the suspected mechanisms that works, is you develop social capital. So maybe someone donates to the, you know, Doug's fundraiser, and he's like, oh, that was a cool thing that person did. And then maybe later down the line, that person, whatever, needs help moving, and they reach out to Doug or whatever, it comes up in conversation and Doug ends up helping them move. I'm not trying to get you to commit to like helping people move if they donate to your fundraiser, but
just an example.
But you develop stronger, typically develop a stronger social network, and you have people you can tap for things like that. So we probably gave away around like 50 grand while we were working, because we worked around 10 years and we aimed to give away around 5,000 a year. And my wife was really involved with the Lincoln Park Zoo and was on a board there. And then I was on a board for Chicago Volunteer Legal Services, which is the largest free legal aid provider in Chicago. So two great causes. And so, yeah, we would give away a good amount of money to those each year. And especially then for us, like us giving away that money, it helped our network then feel like, you know, we would be like, hey, this is what we're giving to this organization this year. We'd love if other people would give too. And then at our employers too, they would let us pool the amount of money that we collected total. And then the employer gets their name, whatever, on some of their marketing materials and stuff like that. And it's like, they're a gold level sponsor. So, you know, that was one of our strategies for helping raise more money for those causes that we supported. And so the way we did this our last year was we knew we were going to be in that top tax bracket. And if you pool all of your charitable donations in one year, you basically get the max tax deduction benefit from doing that. So rather than giving $10,000 spread out over 10 years, if you can give $100,000 in one year, that allows you to avoid taking the standard deduction and instead itemize and then get close to the full $100,000 in value back. That's essentially what we did. So our last year we set up a charitable trust and we put $100,000 in there. You had to transfer specific shares over, and the day that we did the transfer, the market went down a little bit. So it was like $99,000 and some, but our aim was to donate around $100,000 because we were in that top tax bracket. That was about $42,000 in savings. So almost doubled our charitable giving just like that, right off the bat. And then we itemized that year and had high healthcare costs. So that got us another roughly $8,000. So for donating $100,000, we saved $50,000 in taxes. Effectively doubled our charitable giving. We did it through a charitable trust, which we set up through Vanguard, which has very low management fees, just like Vanguard itself. It's a separate organization, but it's their charitable wing. And so now we have a charitable trust. So anytime we give money to charity, we give it from there. It also it's invested in Vanguard mutual funds as well. So it's continued to grow and it's outpaced our giving. And so we're trying to think of just like a big thing that we can give a big chunk of money to, because we're like, this is really bad underspending, you know, for like keeping money away from charities so that it can just keep growing in the stock market. But yeah, so we set up that money, we transferred it over, we did it during our last year of work, and then we kept super good track of all the receipts that we could itemize that year for deduction purposes. And yeah, it ended up being like a huge savings for us and allowed us to give away a big chunk of money, save a lot in taxes. And then now we feel like we're very generous with charities because it's like we've essentially already given away the money. Now it's just taking it from our charitable fund and giving it to the charity itself.
Interesting. Yeah. And it keeps growing and yeah, that's pretty cool.
Yeah. But it doesn't have to be in your last year of retirement to use this strategy either. Cool. Yeah. If you're going to be donating to a charitable, if you're going to be donated to charities a little bit each year, you're much better off, even if you're in the midst of working, to just take a big chunk, transfer it all at once, get the max tax advantage out of that, and then just give any of your subsequent giving, have it come out of your charitable fund.
Got it. Yeah. Last one here is fully funding 529 college savings account.
Yeah. So again, there's some income tax advantages to giving to the 529. So similar to the charitable giving, we had our son born during that first year that we were retired, or that last year that we were working, the same calendar year our son was born. And so we set up the 529 for which he was the beneficiary, and we put $15,000 in there, which with average compounding should be around $87,000 when he's at age 18, which is more than quadruple what my wife and I combined spent on undergrad and graduate school. So we feel like that's pretty good. But you also have the option of changing the beneficiary any year. So we're planning to have more than one kid. So if our son doesn't use all of that, we would transfer it to a younger child. There's some income tax benefit when you contribute to the 529. It depends if you live in a state that has income tax and if they provide an income tax break for 529 contributions, but we were in Illinois, so all those conditions were met. And yeah, by doing that right off the bat in Illinois, where income taxes are somewhat high, you know, 5% a year, it was our $15,000 contribution, 5% of that, I think that's like, you know, $725 or something. So not a huge savings. I think if my math's right. Anyways, I'm self-conscious as a math major, but anytime I do mental math, but that was a small benefit. So not the biggest thing. The big benefit of doing that large contribution off the bat is, I think there's one, it takes a psychological load off because a lot of people are like, well, what about college? And it's just like, if you can just give $15,000 one time when your kid is born, I feel like that sets them up to be able to go to a good university. And as long as they're making a somewhat responsible financial decision. So that's a benefit. And then the other like financial benefit, that all grows tax-free in that 529 account. So might as well put the money in early, let it grow in there instead of growing in our own individual accounts where it would be subject to tax if we take it out. And then the other thing, and this is like a really big topic that we won't be able to get into fully, but there's a huge advantage to what in the law is called inter vivos gifting, which is a Latin fancy lawyer way of saying giving during your lifetime as opposed to giving at your death, because estate taxes only come into play when you die. And if you can be gifting your money throughout your lifetime and then it is transferred to the kids, you avoid any sort of transfer tax. You can even keep it under the annual gift amount, so it's not even really recorded or impacting your estate taxes in any way. And then when you die, you have less money to give to your kids. You're less exposed to estate taxes. And then your kids have all this money that they got early on that's been compounding. And I forget, it's like something like every $1,000 you give your kid when they're born is like almost $600,000 at the age 65. So if you can give your kids $10,000 at birth, you're saying I'm up for a $6 million retirement, which even with inflation should be a pretty comfortable retirement.
So right.
Your kids can start out life coast-fi just by giving them $10,000 at
Interesting.
Birth.
Interesting.
So yeah, again, that's a huge topic.
Right.
I would just say, to the extent you think about building a family legacy, inter vivos gifting is a lot more powerful than the estate planning. And the estate planning gets like 95% of the attention. And this is a powerful consideration.
Interesting. Very good. We covered so much. And in the middle of this, so you all already know this, but in the middle of this, we decided to just do like a marathon recording session. So this is like 2 hours. Is there anything else you thought of that wasn't in the outline that
I feel like I already talked too much. So yeah, but yeah, we had to make it 2 hours. Yeah. Game time decision.
It's amazing. Well, the thing is, we'll wrap this up. It's been amazing. Rusty, thank you for coming up with the idea and doing the research and all this stuff. Fun to have you back in the studio.
Yeah. Good to be here, Doug. Thanks for having me on.
And we're going to get, because people are interested in food, we're going to get Antonio's Pizza here in Longmont, which is supposed to be really good. You've heard a little bit about it?
I have, yeah. Okay. There's some buzz, for sure. All right.
So, yeah, I'm the only thing standing in the way of us getting pizza, so we'll catch y'all later. Thanks to Rusty. I appreciate him joining me for a long two-part episode. The sound check for episode number two, this second part here, is actually from, I believe, the first time Rusty was on the show. So I think the sound check is part of the show, even though it's a tangent and often unrelated. I think they're fun. So I wanted to make sure that we put one here, even though when we recorded the two-hour episode, we didn't want to interrupt the flow or do anything weird by recording another sound check. And the thing is, like, I do the sound check, we actually listen back. But in this case, we just kept recording. We didn't want to interfere with the flow. And it turns out, because we were getting pizza immediately after we recorded, I also didn't want to waste any time. We needed to get out the door. It was really good pizza, by the way. So this is that episode, and Rusty will be joining me sometime soon. He has a great outline put together. And he puts a lot of time and attention. He prepares ahead of time, which is very cool. I do too. I want to make sure, you know, I respect his time or any guests that I have come in here. So hope you enjoyed the two-parter. We'll catch you on the next episode. And thanks a lot. Thanks for listening to the show. That was the Mile High Five podcast. And I'm Doug Cunnington. If you dig the show, please do three things for us. Number one, tell a friend, a family member, an enemy about the show. We really don't care who you tell. Maybe forward them a specific show that you know that they will like. It's the single most helpful thing that you can do to spread the word. It's like giving us a virtual high five, and actually we don't give high fives in person, so the virtual kind's pretty good. And more importantly, your friend or family member or even your enemy will appreciate the fact that you were thinking of them. Number two, make sure you're following or subscribed on your podcast app, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Overcast, YouTube, whatever you're using, and that way you won't miss a show. And number three, please leave us a rating and review. We read them on the show occasionally, and you might hear yours out there on an upcoming episode. Quick disclaimer, this show is not financial or legal advice. I'd actually be surprised if it sounded like it. It's really just for entertainment, and that's at least what we're hoping for. But seriously, get advice from professionals. So we'll catch y'all next week. All right. So remember the sound check we played at the end. So don't say anything too crazy. Yeah. you listen to the show,
yep,
which is cool.
Yeah.
And you mentioned that you had sort of a vision of what my house might be like. You know, Carl talking about the basement and all this stuff. So what's your impression when you came in?
Well, the house is all put together and complete. I guess maybe, you know, hearing Carl on the podcast and talking about all the ongoing house projects that he has. Yeah. And then having seen your basement and just knowing that it was unfinished from briefly seeing it on YouTube and stuff like that, I thought maybe I would anticipate that, but yeah, you're in like a new neighborhood. You have all the, it seems like you have the whole house done and completed and everything like that. So
we have knobs on every door.
You have knobs on every door.
Unlike so. Carl's place. He's not here to defend himself. No, so yeah. It's easy to make fun.
We did it. We saw Carl and Mindy's house just this weekend, actually though too, but his is a lot more complete than, you know, he lets on. So
yeah.
I did notice there weren't knobs on the door, but yeah. So.
It's only a couple of them, like the front door, there's a knob. I don't know about the rest of them, but But yeah, the place has come along. Carl's place has come a long way. Like, they finished a lot more in the kitchen. And like, if you saw it before, you'd be like, oh, wow, this is really amazing. Yeah. So, but yeah, I appreciate you saying that. You know, downstairs, it is a little, I'm a little messy. You could see my desk over there. I don't really, I mean, that's the real deal. Is there's just a bunch of junk laying over there, like a million post-it notes, like 40 pens, half consumed cup of coffee over there. But upstairs, like when we have people over, it's kind of good to have guests show up because like I clean the counter. It's like you got to clean up and make it look like you're not a slob.
Yep,
so yep. Yeah, like clear the counter, throw all the dishes like into the sink, at least so it's hidden, or in a closet. It doesn't even matter where it's at. It's just like hide the stuff.
Yep.
So.
And then what is out stands out. I noticed you had the St. Bernardus coaster out there. Is that one of your favorites?
It is one, especially like this time of year. It's a little for people that don't know, like we're recording this a little early, but it's just a couple weeks before Thanksgiving. Mm-hmm. And this time of year, it's like, it's gotten cooler. It's dark. It's great to pop open the St. Bernardus 12. So are you a St. Bernardus fan too?
Love St. Bernardus for similar reasons. It's my wife's favorite beer, actually. Mm-hmm. And then we went to Belgium for Thanksgiving one year and drank Belgian beers the whole time. And they actually don't have Thanksgiving at that time of year. It's just set up for Christmas. So it's like early Christmas. So this beginning of the season with like Thanksgiving leading into Christmas is like the perfect time to have some of those rich Belgian beers.
Yeah. So. You know what, man? I'll give you, remind me before we go upstairs. So I homebrew beer. I made roughly a clone of like the App 12.
Oh yeah.
Back in Bozeman, and then I like caged and corked it. It's in a 750 bottle. I'll have to show you how to open. I put the corks in a little too far.
Okay.
But anyway, they're pretty good. It could be, I mean, that's several years old. So like, I think the head retention is down a little bit, mm-hmm. but it should be pretty rich, and a darker beer can like deal with oxidation a little bit. When you were over there, did you have like some of the vintages where they're like, oh, here's one from like 10 years ago or whatever?
We didn't do that. They would do, when we lived in Chicago, they would do the vintages for the Bourbon County, KBB, Goose Island.
Yeah. KBC, is that, what is it?
Oh, that's Michigan. That's the Kentucky breakfast stout. Yeah. Okay,
different, got it.
Okay. We'd go over to Michigan though too.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, those are fun stouts to have.
Man. We could just talk about beer the whole time, but this is good for the sound check.
You'll have to start a third podcast. Just have people over and talk about which beers they like.